Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the JASP Podcast, a collaboration between the New Books Network and the Journal of Asian American Studies. I am your host, Chris Patterson, speaking to you from the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Musqueam people on the University of British Columbia campus. This interview is the last of a four-part series featuring winners and honorable mentions of the 2021 Book Awards for the Association of Asian American Studies, or AAAS. Since 1987, the Book Awards at the annual Asian American Studies Association Conference have given valuable attention onto the works in Asian American Studies that have been leading the field. Our last three episodes focused on the Book Awards in Social Sciences, Literary Studies, Poetry, and Fiction. This episode will focus on the winner of the award in Humanities and Cultural Studies in Media, Performance, and Visual Studies. Past winners in these categories include Bernadette Gonzalez's Securing Paradise, Tourism and Militarism in Hawaii and the Philippines, Mimi Nguyen's The Gift of Freedom, War, Debt, and Other Refugee Passages, Lisa Nakamura's Digitizing Race, Visual Cultures on the Internet, and Jasbir Poor's Terrorist Assemblages, Homo Nationalism in Queer Times, among many others. This year, the winning book is Candice Chu's The Difference Aesthetics Makes, On the Humanities After Man, a book that challenges our divisions of aesthetics and politics, while showing how liberal humanism has persisted within the ways we organize in institutions, the ways we teach, and the ways that we think of ourselves. To begin the interview, I will read from the rationale written by the award committee, as we will discuss racial, gendered, and sexual violence. Please remain mindful of where our discussions are going, and take care.
To my mind, one of the things that the book is trying to encourage, and that I found my way to through writing it, I think, is the collective and is the collegial, and how it is that any given object has so many people who are responsible for it.
I'm here with Candice Chu, who is a professor of English, American Studies, and Critical Social Psychology at the CUNY Graduate Center. She is currently working on The Disinherited Teacher, a collection of essays on pedagogies and praxis, and When/Where/How Asia, a project on Asian racialization in the contemporary era. Her new award-winning book is The Difference Aesthetics Makes, On the Humanities After Man, a book that, as the award committee wrote, quote, "stages a capacious epistemological intervention with huge implications for Asian American studies, as well as a host of fields with which it engages, including performance studies, literary studies, critical race theory, queer theory, and philosophy. The Difference Aesthetics Makes stands out because it offers a new direction in the field that decenters the Asian American subject and moves us toward Asian racialization as the task of Asian American critique. The Difference Aesthetics Makes calls for a shift in thinking, encouraging the scholar within and without Asian American studies to research and teach in a way that evacuates attempts to, quote, show our humanity and invest in recognition politics. The theoretical framework Chu offers, a liberal humanism, and the challenge she poses to Asian American studies is inspiring and exciting, as it reminds us of foundational commitments of the field to, quote, ameliorate violence and suffering advanced by racial capitalism and colonialism. The project stages a discussion of relationality and entanglement that is particularly powerful for the ways it links to discussions within Indigenous and queer studies, continuing the work to draw Asian American studies into other realms of minoritarian knowledge production. Choose the Difference Aesthetics Makes continues and expands slash extends Lisa Lowe's influential and foundational book, Immigrant Acts, Laura Kong's Compositional Subjects, and the many works that have been published since, works that refuse to settle and neatly discipline what Asian American studies might inhabit intellectually and pedagogically. And now to the interview. Hi, Candace. Welcome to the podcast, and thank you for coming and being so willing to talk about your book, The Difference Aesthetics Makes.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really happy to be here with you.
So I'm very curious how your reaction, what your reaction was like to winning the EESS Book Award in Cultural Studies, considering that your book is somewhat about the discipline of Asian American Studies. I think in your postscript, you say like it is and is not an Asian American Studies book.
Yeah.
And similarly, it is and it is not a kind of cultural studies text. So can you talk a bit about what this award it means and how you kind of see your book situated within or not situated in those fields?
Sure, absolutely. I have to say when I got the email, I opened it and I was genuinely startled. And so I closed it immediately because I thought this can't be right. I must have read it wrong. I thought this was a mistake. And, you know, there is no reason that this book should have gotten it, because I think of it as such a weird little object that doesn't really fit in any sort of way with any particular field or any particular association. And then I read it again, and I read the citation that the awards committee wrote, and I was really just deeply grateful and really delighted, and not so much because of the award, perhaps, but I think because of the association. You know, EESS holds space for so many of us. And it was the first association conference that I went to as a grad student in the early 90s. And it is the one that I remember, and I think still kind of functions this way. It's like the place that you go and you can see other people doing the sorts of work and having the same kinds of obsessions that you do, where for, you know, most of us working certainly across the U.S. and Canada, I think where you are, we're really the only ones in our institutions doing this sort of work. So there was just like this, I have this immense sense of gratitude that this association that I cherish so much actually would want to acknowledge anything that I've done. And then I have a lot of kind of practical gratitude, which is about, I'm so aware of the labor that it takes to run an association, but also to do things like serve on book awards and book award committees. And most of that, I think all of that labor is volunteer, right? Nobody's getting compensated for it. And we all do it because it is really an act of collegiality and commitment to a field and to project, a collective project, a mutuality. And those are the things that I think, you know, those are the really meaningful things, the things that we do well. And we do well as an association, we do well as a field. And I'm really mindful of all of the time and effort that it takes for people to do this sort of work. So all of that, I'm really grateful. As for in terms of it being the book award in cultural studies, it both does and doesn't make sense to me. I mean, insofar as I'm really glad that it is taken as something that registers as a contribution to the kinds of conversations and debates that cultural studies as a field stands for, right? So always engaging the political, always thinking about social formation, always thinking about the work that we do in the academy as embedded in the greater social and historical field. And that for me, you know, I wrote a book that was emphasizing the language of aesthetics, that there's not necessarily a correlation to these other domains or these other registers of critical work. So, you never know when something goes out, when you write something and you put it out into the world, how it will be received. And so I'm just pleased. I'm pleased.
Well, I do want to talk about that the culture wars that you talk about in the book.
Yeah.
But first, I do want to think about, as you mentioned, the impact of of the association and also of Asian American studies as a field on your own work by going back to your first book in 2003, which is Imagine Otherwise, which made quite big. I just read it for the first time in 2008 or 2009, and it still felt so freshing and new as a grad student at that time. So I'm always stunned, like, oh, that got published in 2003. My goodness, because it felt so of it. It still feels quite relevant to this day. But it made quite big waves, and now it's seen as a kind of must-read book in the field. And in that book, you argue that the term Asian American can be reframed not by its subjects or objects, but by its critique and its own history as a constructed identity. And you talk about some of the afterlife of this book at the end of your new book in the postscript. Yeah. But can you talk a bit about that? Like, how has its afterlife been, and how has it pushed you to write this book?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So I went to grad school in the early 1990s at the same institution that you did, it turns out, University of Washington. And I think if you were in graduate school in the early 1990s and you had any kind of interest in ethnic literary studies, in race theory and critical race studies, it was impossible not to take seriously the critique of identity and the critique of identity, both as a politics, but also as a critical paradigm. And if you took that to heart, as I did, you know, I really believed the critique of identity, that there were limitations to it as a kind of organizing principle, but also a critical paradigm, that we really needed to be theorizing beyond, right? Theorizing in other modes and alternative ways of thinking and approaching our work. I mean, taking to heart such work like Lisa Lowe's formative essay, The Heterogeneity, Hybridity, and Multiplicity. It's later, you know, became a chapter in Immigrant Acts, but it came out earlier as a standalone essay. We could also think about Laura Kang's book, right, Compositional Subjects, which won this award in the early 2000s when it came out, or Karen Shimakawa's National Abjection. I mean, we were all trying to figure out how to navigate post-identity critique, right? That is to say, like, what are we going to do in light of the critique of identity? And I think, so that was part of it, but the other side of it was that while there was this critique of identity, there was also a very strong sense of the coherence of Asian American as a rubric, right, as a political and social subject category. So trying to contend simultaneously with its seeming coherence and its fundamental instability, right? And that's really where that book came out of. You know, the Imagine Otherwise was really something that is me trying to figure out how to make use of that term, of this term, Asian American. And in the context of doing things like engaging the AAAS, right, of going places where there was a sense that there is a conversation in common around the study of what Asian American means and doesn't mean, how it comes to mean something, how it comes to seem knowable. So for me, I was really trying to think about what the field or how we might think about Asian American studies in terms of its epistemological impact, rather than, or in addition to, thinking about it as a political and social project, right? So it isn't that the politics and the kind of other dimensions of it, right, are separable from its epistemological domain. So the modes of knowing and the valuation and the kinds of truths that we are trying to produce vis-a-vis Asian American studies or Asian Americanist critique are inseparable from the address of racial formation, from the address of racial capitalism, and so on. But they're not. But we cannot talk about them in terms of identity. So we have to find another language to think through that. And that for me was this kind of, you know, really trying to separate out a sense of a critical approach versus something that seemed to be causally related to some, you know, kind of congealed subject called the Asian American. And, you know, for better or worse, I mean, I think that it was for me helpful in thinking through as a process of writing that book. And I would say that its reception is an indication that other people were also grappling with those questions, right? So that is to say, when we see texts emerge that become, you know, that get awards or that become central reading, you know, readings in common, I tend to think of them in the way that Raymond Williams thinks about keywords, right? Like the conditions of emergence, you know, they tell us something, those moments tell us something more about the conditions of emergence than they do necessarily about the qualities of the object, object itself. So I would say that that book's reception and the fact that it feels still current and contemporary to us is in some ways because racial essentialism is still there, right? And so long as racial essentialism is still present, we are still going to have to be working to derive and employ methods that don't trap us into those modes, right? Don't trap us into essentialist identity categories. And, you know, I don't know that it's a must-read book, honestly. I'm really glad that people find it useful, but I'm not sure that there aren't other works that could also do that.
Well, maybe your new book will be the next must-read book.
I don't know about that. I will say, actually, I mean, I'll take this opportunity to say, Imagine Otherwise, in a funny way, oftentimes the thing that I hear most quoted is the title, Imagine Otherwise. It's a great title. It's a phrase that I took from Avery Gordon's Ghostly Matters, which is a phenomenally good book, you know, and I often find myself having to correct people to say, that's actually not my phrase, it's actually Avery Gordon's. And there used to be a fuller discussion of Ghostly Matters in Imagine Otherwise itself, but it got edited out at some moment, you know, in whatever drafting. But I think, you know, the whole point that Gordon was trying to make, and the one that I was trying to pick up on, was the idea that we are working to not only imagine otherwise, but actually to imagine otherness itself otherwise, right? To imagine that as a fundamentally different thing than it's been given to us as. And, you know, it's kind of refusing that category of the minority. It's refusing the category of the abject other and saying that we can play in that and, you know, kind of seeing how the literature and the arts that come to us actually do that work for us.
Well, this leads us to your new book, and forgive me for this incredibly cheesy transition, but perhaps one way of imagining otherness otherwise is through the difference that aesthetics makes. There you go. But it does feel like there is a continuation of some of these ideas, focusing more on the humanities, right, writ large, than Asian American subjectivity so much. But is the difference, oh my God, I'm going to say it again, but is the difference aesthetics makes one way of imagining otherness otherwise?
I think so. I mean, I think it is for me. And thank you for that pivot. I think, you know, there was at some point I was giving some kind of a book talk on the difference on Imagine Otherwise. And someone asked, you know, because I use the term subjectless in that book. And I said, well, if Asian American studies is subjectless, what are we left with? You know, is it just kind of a void? And I found that a really good question, right? And it's a question that Imagine Otherwise absolutely did not, I don't think I had even considered it as part of the domain or part of the horizon of that project. It isn't that the difference aesthetics makes. I didn't set out to produce a response to it, but I do think that in a way, that is what has happened. You know, it's over 15, 20 years of writing, reading and writing beyond the research for Imagine Otherwise. I think I sometimes talk with my students. You know, I work in a institution now that we only have graduate students, we only have doctoral students. So they are both my students and also my colleagues, right? And I think part of the conversation that we have regularly is about how a book or an article or a talk or a class or whatever that thing is only ever a particular manifestation of a much bigger project, right? And thinking of them in that way, for me, and you know, hopefully for my students and my colleagues, it alleviates the sense that everything has to be perfect because you can't ever say everything that you need to. Yeah, I think of these two monographs in this way, and so in the kind of most abbreviated form, I think of the first book. I think I was responding to what was then, and maybe is still a ubiquitous question: is what is Asian American literature? By focusing on the Asian American side, right, of that, what is Asian American literature? And I think in this later book, I was trying to figure out the literature. What is the literature of Asian American literature? And that question generally keys into what I've never been able to shake off, which is my interest in the kind of meta question, right? The questions that ask us to reflect on what it is that we're doing when we claim to be Asian Americanists, when we claim to be American as literary scholars, and so on, how we come to our objects of inquiry, how we come to the approaches, et cetera. So for me, what is literature is a question that connects me to aesthetics and to the humanities, and partly because I've spent my professional life in English departments. So I came through an English department at the University of Washington during a time when a lot of our training was in cultural studies. So the people I worked with there were really cultural studies practitioners, but also working in the ethnic studies department, being trained by Sean Wong and Linda Revilla. And my first teaching was in ethnic studies and Asian American studies. So trying to grapple with what it meant to be in an English department and feeling like a failed English professor, right? I don't have that kind of the canonical English has never been what the stuff that makes me really, excited or happy. I mean, some of it does, but as a whole, it hasn't. And somebody who, says that I'm attached to interdisciplinarity and interdisciplinary projects, but I really love literature. I really like books. I like prose, and I like writing in a kind of flat-footed, mundane, in the most common sense of that. So I wanted to understand what it was that I was doing in an English department as an Asian Americanist. And that's really where this project came from. It is also a project that is the post-tenure project, right? So I felt like I could read the things that I didn't have a chance to, or really was turned fairly decidedly away from, aesthetics, philosophy, which I had understood through my graduate studies to be the domain of the politically conservative, right? Cultural studies was where the politically progressive went, and aesthetics was really the people who didn't want to have anything to do with race or gender or sexuality, and certainly couldn't recognize Asian American literature as a proper field of literary studies. So that's a lot of the sorts of immediate prompts that brought me to the project. And then there's this kind of, in the 15 years that, that unfolded between my starting to think about these questions and when it actually came out, that was the time when the critique of the humanities and the crisis of the humanities were simultaneously unfolding everywhere. And the critique of liberalism and multiculturalism and diversity, through post-colonial studies and decolonial studies, in Asian American studies, it was the Pacific Islander critique, right, of kind of American formations or nationalist formations that weren't sufficiently attentive to empire and weren't sufficiently attentive to the impact of the colonial and settler colonialism in particular. And at the same time, recognizing that by that time, many of us had actually, we'd been tenured in our institutions, not a lot. I mean, many of us is not by any means a dramatic, dramatic number, but we had gotten to have a space in an institutional location. And because of a lot of work and a lot of effort by a lot of people in and outside of the academy. So for me, in kind of what was sort of my mid-career, I thought, well, I could spend the next 20 years hand-wringing. I could leave the academy altogether, or I could actually try to figure out whether there is something to be done with where we are, to make use of the location of where we are, and to kind of inhabit an English department in a different way, and see what was possible. And that's a lot of, what this book is actually trying to, it's sort of a book version of the kind of conversations that I often have that are about, how do we actually do our work within these spaces that really don't want us to be here? And not as individuals, but rather kind of as a field or as a challenge to the canonical modes that the university has been organized, by which the university has been organized, and certainly through the humanities. So the more that I read, the more I just came to understand that the English discipline, the discipline of English, but also the humanities writ large, we have been so important to the buttressing of colonial modernity, right? The buttressing of liberalism, that how could we not take up our positions to try to do something else, right? It seemed no longer an option, seemed no longer viable to not try to do something else, rather than you know, continuing to just be unhappy about all, you know, all of the different things that were happening. And in the practical sense, and this is something that I wrote in the book too, I kept hearing all of the discourse around, you know, not just we must defend the humanities, but also we must defend the humanities because they are so important to sort of the noble causes of civilization, right? Civilization will collapse without the humanities. And, you know, when you come from kind of an epistemological and political position where you are always critiquing versions of civilization, right? It's very difficult to stand in defense of them. But you also can't, I couldn't help but notice also that they were really ineffective arguments. Funding for public education was not coming back as a recourse of that. Universities weren't suddenly saying, oh, that's right, this is really important. These noble pursuits are really important. Let us put more money or let us put more resources into the humanities. In fact, it was still kind of, you know, the depth of defunding has been enormous, at least in the U.S. context. And it doesn't make sense to me to continue to try to argue something that isn't working. So there again, I just wanted to see, you know, is there something else that we could do? And that's it. That was all I was trying to figure out in this book.
Well, that something else does come through pretty strongly, right, in the introduction. And you do begin the book discussing this defense of the humanities. And I recall in your when you were president of the American Studies Association, your main speech that's like still on YouTube, everyone can still go watch it, is like is about this, right? The desire to just defend the humanities, but more through the idea of academic freedom, right. But here you turn that argument more towards what you call illiberal humanism, that can recognize how the humanities has and continues to contribute to the reproduction of the subjugation and to the definitions of the human. So can you talk a bit about this argument? Because as you say also in the introduction, it's different than like a new materialist argument that would try to blur the boundaries of the human with animal, cyborg, and so on, and objects, that you still want to hold on to like the human of the humanism, I guess, but to also show something different. So like, can you explain this a bit?
Sure. I mean, I guess maybe one place to start is I'm really uncomfortable with the term illiberal. I know I use it. I probably should have marked more specifically that I am uncomfortable with it. And it's not because I want to disavow it or anything. I'm just not sure that it does the work that I want it to do, which is to say, right, following Sylvia Winter's kind of robust work, you know, amazing kind of capacious work that really makes it so clear how narrow the particular genre of human, the particular genre of man is that we have, that has been imposed on us through the systems that have established colonial modernity as the historical dominant, right? When you recognize that, when you recognize the kind of parochialism of that, then that the kind of an amazing horizon opens up to recognize that all of these things that we have been reading and thinking and feeling and sensing through the literature and the art that comes to us, not by those who seemingly exemplify the ideal of the enlightened subject, the liberal subject, right? But actually those who are cast aside precisely so that ideal can emerge. For me, what happened was I could start to understand how those were not arguments for humanization, but rather arguments that we recognize the limitations of the particular version of the human that has been given to us, right? And that those limitations are not merely, or not only to be understood as a consequence of exclusion, right? It's not simply that if we could make that capacious enough to include everybody, then it would be fine, right? It's not an assimilationist argument, but rather that in the conceptualization of that human itself, it requires the subjugation of others, right? There is no way for that human not to require that kind of dehumanization of others. Yeah. But of course, you know, people who have been dehumanized by that system are fully robust and wonderfully alive and amazingly smart beings in the world, right? And so if we can tap into the kinds of humanisms that come out of those, that rendering, right? That rendering that does not depend on the subjugated exclusion of others in order for the stabilization of the particular idealized form of the human. What an amazing difference that might make, right? What an amazing difference that it has already made. Okay? So I'm using those two tenses in part because one of the things that I wanted to do was to think a little about the temporalities that we use when we're talking about kind of politically engaged work. And it isn't that, you know, and here I'm really informed by the work of people like Jose Munoz and Gayatri Gopinath and Martin Manalansen and Rod Ferguson and Siobhan Somerville. You know, a lot of people are working in queer theory and queer color critique. Chandam Reddy, you know, like all of these people who have really made it clear that it's not enough just to point to the limitations or to render possibility as something that's always on the horizon, right? But rather to acknowledge and proliferate and amplify all of the different forms of being and knowing and desire that are possible, that have always been possible, despite and because and in difference to the systems that are trying to eradicate otherness, right? The systems that are trying to eradicate radical difference in some way. And I think that that's that sensibility, right? And it was, it really, I'm using the term deliberately, sensibility. I think it's that sensibility that I think might be kind of amazing for us as a, as an organized thing to try to bring to bear through our various institutional locations. You know, what would we mean? What would it be if we're no longer arguing against a particular form, but for something else? And that for something else is illiberal humanism, right? It's not a perfect term. It's an imperfect term for something that I'm trying to get to, which is trying to fill out more positive terms rather than always staying on the negative side of critique, right? To get to something that we can actually move toward, you know, stand for rather than against. And, you know, I'm not sure that we are well trained to do that. And so I'm trying to follow the lead of other people, you know, writers who I think, and artists who I think do that work, are always trying rendering something into being that wasn't there before.
I'm going to mount a very small defense of illiberal as a term, yeah. Liberal humanism.
Sure.
Just because I liked it a lot, partially because, as you say in the book, you're trying to like think about human and man outside of the like typical genre of man, as Sylvia Winter puts it, and that the liberalness is one of the most important features of it. And so instead of necessarily going to humanism or the human, it's about, you know, liberal, it's about a particular kind of bourgeois imagining of the human. And so making that, you know, ill is part of it. So that's the first small difference. The second that when I first heard it, I was like, for some reason, I thought you might say this in the book, and I didn't read it as closely as I could have. So maybe you do. But I was like, I immediately thought of hip hop, and like, especially like early 90s, late 80s hip hop, how like, you know, you could be the illest, or it's time to get ill. You know, and so rather than saying you're the best, being the illest at something,
I would love that. I mean, I really wish I had that as part of the genealogy. I can't claim that though. But it's really, you know, I'm glad, and I'm glad to hear that it's a useful term. I love the connection that you're making to early hip hop, but I think my pause is that I don't. The point was not to try to say, okay, and so now we must all form a liberal humanist studies, right? Like the idea was not to try to get to a new object of study or a new object of inquiry, but rather to shift our thinking in the ways that we think about ethnic literatures, right? Asian American literature. So that, you know, and this is one of the propositions in the book, which is to say, well, Asian American, really take it as a modifier. How does it modify literature, right? And can that modification be thought of as a kind of humanism, an illiberal one, which is to say, it's difficult sometimes to get people to recognize liberalism as part of the problem of racism or part of the problem of colonial modernity, right? It's much easier to think that liberalism is a solution, and much easier because everything in the U.S. political and cultural landscape points us toward that direction, right? Rule of law, if we just follow the rule of law, then everything will be fine. People just have to behave in a more civilized way. We have to stop hate. This is the new thing right now, right? I mean, the new idiom or the language that's been emerging. And then everything will be fine. And those are all kind of liberal categories, you know, empathy, of law, of civilizational discourses. And so to try to get people off of the liberal platform is, for me, in an English department, certainly, and within a university setting, is for me a harder project than it is to point to kind of more overt acts of racism that people don't see as acts of liberalism, right? But I think actually are in some ways. So, you know, that's where the ill was actually something that pulled at me, because I often see illiberal attached to things like uprisings, right? Or protests on the street. Like, these are illiberal, and so therefore they're bad. And it's like, actually, I don't know that they're bad, right? I think that they're eruptions of, you know, different forms of being that are coming into the world. And they're, I don't want to celebrate them. I want to be able to look at them for what they are, right? For the real ways in which they're experienced. And sometimes those experiences and sometimes those realities are not all desirable. But I do think that they are certainly a difference, a necessary difference from what we are given as the only and the inevitable options that are available to us. Because those only and inevitable options have done so much damage, you know, continue to do so much damage. And we know that. We have this knowledge, and we need to do other things with it. You know, there's some part of this too that for me, and this is the aesthetic part, I think is, this is about desire, right? This is about how we know what to desire and whom to desire and whom to fear and whom to hate. And those are for me fundamentally aesthetic questions. And there, aesthetic is not, I don't mean to isolate that away from politics or away from anything else, but rather really to use it as a term that's talking about how, our bodies are organized and oriented towards something and against other things, right? And that those orientations and organizations happen through the institutionalized mechanisms that reward and punish, you know? I think that until and unless we proliferate all the possibilities of the different desires that are out there, you know, just telling people that capitalism is bad, again, like that's one of those arguments, it just hasn't worked, right? I mean, not for everyone, sometimes it does, but there has to be other alternatives that are being put into play. And for me, those alternatives, you know, there's so many of them and a kind of a rich proliferation of them that comes out through the literatures and the artwork of people who are minoritized within the prevailing systems.
Let's get to that, to some of those other ways and sensibilities that you discuss in the book. Mm-hmm. And this kind of grows out of two things. I don't know if I'd call them critiques exactly. They're, you know, there are lessons, I suppose, that and reflections on what's happened since, like, Asian American studies has grown as a field, has become more institutionalized. Yeah. And the first is that, as you put it in the book, that this institutionalization could mean that existing disciplines could remain at least at a radical level, relatively untouched by difference. And so how could we reimagine or see aesthetics as affecting that? And then the second reflection, I suppose, would be that through the cultural turn, the culture wars of the 80s, we've begun to erase aesthetics, or, as you put it, to see them as apolitical.
Yeah.
And so what is at stake then in realizing the imbrication of aesthetics and politics?
Yeah. you know, these are gigantic questions.
Yes. That's why I put them together.
Yeah. I would say, I mean, I guess in terms of the institutionalization, you know, I'm following the lead of people like Rod Ferguson and Jody Melamed, who have written about how the formalization of fields like ethnic studies and like women's studies and gender and sexuality studies, they've enabled the, you know, this is one of the ways that universities have managed difference, right? To use Ferguson's term, they've enabled canonical disciplines to remain unchanged. So, you know, if you do gender, then you have a whole department now. Why should English have to deal with it? You know, if you have an Asian American studies program, then why would you need to have somebody in history who does Asian American history? And, you know, I am overstating this in some ways. I mean, there have been, I think that there have been huge differences that have been made in terms of the various locations, right, that have been populated by now Asian American historians and Asian Americanist literary critics and so on. But I don't know that the disciplines themselves have fundamentally changed, right? And I, you know, some of this is also kind of practically driven. In the last, 10 years or so, when we've seen departments and units cut wholesale, you know, and oftentimes they are the units that, or they get consolidated, right? So that you have all of the ethnic studies units now under one rubric because it's going to be an administrative efficiency. You know, that's sometimes the language. I think there is a way that the formalization and the institutionalization of particular programs and departments have made it very easy. You know, it's tidy for an administrator to kind of manage that difference in that way, right? And what remains untouched in kind of a literal way are the canonical disciplines, right? Those formations don't have to undergo the same kinds of challenges or demands, right? And that's not to say that history and English and art history and, you know, music and all that, they haven't also been cut, but it's for different reasons, or the rationalization around that, I think, has unfolded in a different way. So some of this is about, you know, it's something that Rod Ferguson and I have talked about, and I don't know if he's written about it somewhere, but it's as a kind of a Trojan horse method, right? Like, there's no reason that you can't be in an English department and teach the Introduction to American Literature course and teach only writings by people of color, right? There isn't any reason that you can't be in a biology department and teach epistemology that has to do with the racialization, right? So I never want to argue against institutionalization, because what that means is gathering resources and infrastructure. And resources and infrastructure are crucial to holding space open for people and for ideas that can't, that don't have room otherwise, right? And I will never argue against that. But I don't think that that should be the end of our process, right? I think that that's one piece of what we do. And then I think we need to seed ourselves and our ideas and our epistemological formations everywhere, right? So that it no longer becomes possible for institutions to, you know, make the really, to my mind, really ridiculous demographic arguments. Well, we have 16% Asian people on our campus, and therefore we should have an Asian American Studies program. The demographic argument always reduces what is an epistemological and an intellectual field into something that's about identity, right? So I think if we continue to push against that, that might help us kind of produce a certain cushion against the ways that higher education, that management tries to manage difference, right? That administration tries to manage difference. And that we can do that ourselves, right? We can actually play within the categories. You know, you're assigned a composition course, teach it in the way that makes sense to you. And we don't have to buy into the segregations of aesthetics and politics. We can actually do the thing that we do and explain and kind of understand why and how that works to try to kind of put, puncture marks or shift the field in these kind of micro maneuvers a little bit, the field of kind of the canonical disciplines. And I do think that is about there is something to me about not giving up, not conceding such categories like aesthetics that are so big and so weighty and carry a lot of force or power or authority, something like that, I don't know why we would want to give up that terrain. You know, I think all of that is, that is the stuff that we do, you know, and that it isn't a matter of trying to get institutional recognition for it so much as actually just making use of it to do the thing that we want to do, which is shift the common sense, shift the ways in which the idea of the Asian or the idea of the racial minority or the idea of racism, right, and what that looks like and how it plays out is understood in a kind of broad-based way. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that institutionalization is always a question. I never want to give up on institutions because, you know, they are places where there are resources and infrastructures, but I don't ever think that we want to attach to institutionalization as the point of what we do. It is an important means, but it's not really the end or the horizon. And there have always been other ways that people have created space and made room and done the kind of intellectual heavy lifting that we're trying to do in Asian American studies, but in unrecognized forms. And I don't think that we ever should feel like if we lose the university as a site, then that's the end, right? You know, liberation movements, revolutionary thinking has happened everywhere on the streets always. So.
I do want to lead to some silly questions now,
yeah.
If you don't mind.
Yeah.
Because I like asking these questions because authors respond in ways that they wouldn't in most interviews. And so I'm just curious. But I want to ask about like your most favorite and least favorite moments on the book when you're reflecting on it. And most favorite could be like the parts that are kind of just silly and or make you feel warm. And like, I hope the reader like gets that this is like a fun moment.
Yeah.
And then the least favorite could be like the the parts where you might feel like, oh, this was so hard to write. I don't want to be reminded of this. Or, you know, that you just have less happy feelings about.
That's interesting. The most favorite thing is really difficult because I think I don't have a relationship to writing in that way. Writing is really hard for me. I mean, writing anything is really hard, but especially this, and this not being this particular book, but writing for public consumption generally, I think is really difficult. And it's in part because it feels like I write so that I can understand something. And I hope that, and then I try to publish it so that I hope that it will be useful and interesting to other people. But it is, you just throw it out there and then you don't really know what's going to happen to it on the other end, right? So all of it feels difficult and hard in some ways. I will say I was so glad to get to the end of the process of the project, making it into a book. So that I could say thank you to people, you know, so that the acknowledgements could happen finally. And that I think must be the favorite moment in the book. I mean, there's actually, you know, there are some other people that I should have included, or I would have liked to include, you know, things like that. So it's tinged in a way, but, and it's not just because of the thanks, but because to my mind, one of the things that the book is trying to encourage, and that I found my way to through writing it, I think, is the collective and is the collegial and how it is that any given object has so many people who are responsible for it, right? That it isn't an author who writes. It isn't a single person who is working, but rather these, you know, many, 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 many people who are responsible to and for the kind of work that is possible in any given moment. And I think that's partly why I would say that the acknowledgments are really, they're precious to me. The hardest part or the most difficult, I think probably I would say it's actually that the chapter that has to do with the category of the universal. I'm still grappling with it. And I don't think I really came to as clear an understanding of what I wanted to do with that term and that word and that concept in that chapter as I would have liked to before sending it off. But there was a moment when I felt like I can't take this any further. I don't know what else to do with it. And I have exhausted my ability to be working inside of this particular iteration of, you know, thought. So I just wanted to send it out into the world in that way. So it is just, it's a, you know, I'm just admitting to acknowledging the flaws, I suppose. But, you know, still, there's still that hope, right, that other people can do something with it and something more than what you want. I framed it in terms of propositions in part because I really wanted it to be like a conversation, you know, like, what do you think? What do you think if we think about this in this way? What do you think? And that's all I ever want, really. It's just a good conversation. And I hope that the ideas in the book will be useful for other people in that way.
I remember a wise person once told me that everything you write could be kind of a transition to the next thing you write or to what other people are going to write following. And
yeah,
I feel like this book is especially generative in that way. There's so much in it that, you know, what I want to do with your term illiberal to think about illist is could be part of that conversation going forward. Even though it's not at all what you might mean when you use it. But there's so much going on like that, that I feel like, I could really build on other people's, that other people could build off of.
That's so great. You know, I mean, that's the fun part, right? You put something out and somebody else takes it and runs with it in a different direction. And it's just, I don't know, like that is how we create the worlds, right? That is how we bring to bear the worlds that we inhabit, you know, bring to bear those kinds of connections and the sorts of filaments that we're not always aware of, but that just, I don't know, it's really exciting and kind of the best part of what we do, right, is actually to be a part of that and to have any sense of belonging in that sort of conversation. You know, that's everything. That's such a gift to have that. So I'm really grateful to you for the time that you're taking with this.
Of course. Yeah. No, it's my pleasure always. And when I publish the article, The Illest Illiberal in the Room, I'm going to credit this conversation. So Candice Chu definitely agrees with this term. It's awesome.
You know, I thought that you were going to say the illicit, you know, and I was like, oh, that's really interesting. Illicit humanism, right? Like there's some play, there's some fun play to be done with this.
Well, it's exactly that merging that you discuss in the intro. It's like, I can't exactly remember where these ideas came from. Like they came out of conversations a lot of the time.
That's right. Right. Yeah. And isn't that, I mean, you know, it's like, and oftentimes it's like the things that you were chatting about in the hallway after a conference session, right? Or, you know, over a drink and somebody just says the exact turn of phrase that is really great. And it kind of, you know, taps you into something else. I mean, a lot of the stuff that's in this book, but really everything that I teach or write about or talk about, it's the stuff that I can't shake off, right? It's like somebody said something or read something and I can't really quite make sense of it and it haunts me. And so the objects are always selecting me. And this is, you know, one of the things that I talk about with my students. And the things that you can't shake off are the things that are actually your body is trying to tell you, like, pay attention to me, right? And then once you start doing that, something else happens. And if you're lucky, that's your job, right? Is to actually not just do that for yourself, but actually to allow other people to work. And that's the pure gift of what we get to do, I think. Despite all of the kinds of crazinesses that happen inside of universities and institutions, we do have these sorts of networks and these sorts of, infrastructures. I think it's infrastructure building, right? That's necessary to create the worlds and to inhabit the worlds that we know are possible. You know, it's like we don't even have to imagine them. We know that they're possible. And AAAS is a part of that, I think. I don't know. I like to think about it anyway. It helps.
This has been such an inspirational conversation. But I feel like I have to end it. I don't want to take too much of your time. But I want to end by asking you about your current projects. And you mentioned, too, The Disinterested Teacher, a collection of essays on pedagogies and praxis, and another, The When, Where, How, Asia, which is on Asian racialization, which is kind of how you end this book, too, talking about Asian racialization.
Right.
But can you talk about both or either of those?
Sure, yeah. And I'm trying to be brief about that. I mean, The Disinterested Teacher came in part because it occurred to me in finishing Difference Aesthetics Makes that it's actually a book that's about pedagogy. And I should have recognized that earlier on, but I just didn't. And that actually the turn toward the construct of pedagogy came through my work through the American Studies Association and working with Laura Kang and Alex Vasquez and Siobhan Somerville in building that program, but also then with Rod Ferguson, who stepped in as president right after me. And we were really talking about pedagogy in a kind of robust way, right? Not only what we do in a classroom and not only about theories of teaching and learning, but rather how urban spaces are designed or how our houses are designed or, you know, things like access and infrastructure, you know, all those sorts of things that orient us in particular ways. That for me is all pedagogy, right? Even access to good food or to clean water, right? All of that is part of our pedagogical structures. So I wanted to think about how pedagogy and aesthetics were connected together and also to really try to give some, you know, kind of writerly room to that thing that I spend most of my professional life doing, which is thinking about teaching and teaching and being in a classroom and devising syllabi, you know, all those sorts of things, because I don't really spend as much time doing this kind of writing, right? The kind of writing that leads to a book. And it's not, I'm not bemoaning it. That's just kind of how my, the way in which I relate to our profession, that's how it has unfolded. And this it's a preference as much as it is a kind of structural construct. So that's partly why I've decided that, you know, it's a collection of essays. It's not research in quite the same mode. Some of it is just picking up on things that I had already written in the past, and other pieces are newer, just kind of thinking through it with the hope that it will help, you know, it, again, like be part of how we help each other do our work. Right. So I'm trying to find a way of publishing it or making it available that it doesn't necessarily have to be as costly as an academic press book and, you know, those sorts of things. So I have some of that to figure out as well. But I will say, you know, as I was finishing The Difference Aesthetics Makes, I had some serious health issues come up. And on the other end of that, when I emerged, because I had been thinking about contemporary Asian racialization for quite a while, I just could not bring myself to think like, oh, if this is the thing that I want to, you know, now that I'm healthy again, like, do I really want to spend my time thinking about Asia? I was like, actually, I think I want to think about teaching. And so that was partly why this project took priority. It was intended to be done a year ago, and then COVID happened. And the combination of COVID and chairing English during that time just meant that it's been pushed off. And that's fine. It's not, there's nothing that feels so, you know, kind of urgently pressing about it. The other project is something I just, you know, I think all of us, yourself included, and certainly actually, you know, this kind of goes back also to Vancouver again, thinking about how Asia does and doesn't work as a racial category. Right. And particularly as we've pivoted into the 21st century and people are talking about the Asian Pacific century or the Pacific century or the Asian century and what that means and how we are to understand those terms and how we are to understand Asianness within that construct, just like for other people, has been really interesting to me. And as it has coincided with so much necessary attention to anti-Blackness, so much necessary attention to settler colonialism and so on, right? So how do these formations work in relation and in sync with each other? There was also a moment when I wanted to think about the histories of, not a moment, but about, you know, one of the threads linking to that project is trying to think through the histories of the critique of Orientalism that on the one hand has given rise to much of the work that we do through Asian American studies, right? This kind of a sense of how Asian American studies answers and tries to interrupt Orientalism. But there's also the figure of the Arab and the Arab American, right? And that is also produced through and as a resistance to or kind of in response to Orientalism. But Asianness and Arabness aren't always or often talked about in the same critical space. So not, you know, I think in the real, actually, there's a lot of politics and a lot of kind of social movements that are in solidarity or in community with each other. But as critical terms, we don't necessarily think about them together. And I wanted to think a little about that and what that might mean to new institutional formations to bring that to bear, to bring to bear a space where Arabness and Asianness are actually always thought in sync with each other. And so that, you know, it's that kind of jumble of questions. And still for me, right, it's the kind of meta questions, you know, how are we doing this? When is Asia? And what are we doing? And that's in concert with some of the students I've had the great, great good fortune of working with. At the Grad Center at CUNY.
Well, Candace, this was such an awesome conversation. I might have to make this into its own podcast, actually, because it's been so so inspirational and so useful, I think.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this.
So thank you. And it's really nice to talk to you.
Thank you for listening to the JASP podcast, a collaboration between the Journal of Asian American Studies and the New Books Network. It is produced by the Journal of Asian American Studies with the help of the Social Justice Institute at the University of British Columbia. It is mixed by myself, and the music featured in it is by the local Vancouver band Necking.